ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. There's no government shutdown after House Speaker Kevin McCarthy recruited Democrats to help pass a short-term funding measure President Biden ultimately signed it just before midnight. But today, McCarthy's chief Republican critic, Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida, tells ABC's This Week he will introduce a motion to remove McCarthy as the Speaker of the House.
If at this time, next week, Kevin McCarthy is still Speaker of the House, it will be because the Democrats bailed him out and he can be their Speaker, not mine.
Gaetz was on ABC's This Week. Meanwhile, congressional supporters of military aid for Ukraine says there will be more. That's after the short-term measure that passed Saturday did not include any aid. About 28 million student loan borrowers back on the hook today after the federal pause on payments comes to an end after 3 years. And Turkey's interior minister says a suicide bomb in the capital of Ankara occurred before parliament was set to reopen and two police officers were slightly hurt. This is ABC News. Former President Donald Trump's civil trial gets underway tomorrow in New York City, despite an effort to delay the case. ABC's Melissa Adon has a preview.
Trump and his companies facing a $250 million lawsuit that was brought on by the New York State Attorney General's office. Now, they are alleging that Trump and his business falsified business records to inflate the value of his assets. The AG is planning to call on Trump and his sons, Eric and Don Jr., as well as his daughter Ivanka, to the stand during the trial.
Trial expected to take several months. It could lead to Trump and his business losing properties in the state of New York. Another former president celebrates a milestone birthday today. Former President Jimmy Carter turns 99, more than 6 months after his family announced that he had entered hospice care. And in California, military plane carrying the body of Senator Dianne Feinstein returned to her hometown of San Francisco. No funeral plans have yet been announced. Brian Clark, ABC News.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It's the Wild West of how students are using generative AI.
As educators, there's sort of six responses that we can have to these new tools. We could ignore it. Mm-hmm. We could ban it. We can try and outfox it. We can teach about it. We can actually teach it, or we can teach with it. I think the most exciting one, of course, is to teach with it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A former Wisconsin U.S. Senator is speaking out against the idea of a constitutional convention. Russ Feingold warns it would push through sweeping new right-wing policies. Suzanne Potter reports.
Right-wing groups such as the Federalist Society say they want to require a balanced budget and limit the power to tax, moves critics say would lead to huge cuts in Medicare, Social Security, education, Medicaid, and environmental protection. Duke University professor Nancy McLean notes that Article 5 of the Constitution requires consent from just two-thirds of states to call for a convention.
The organizers of the convention effort have made clear the votes taken would not be based on population, but on one vote per state, so as to grossly underrepresent the majority of Americans.
That would give outsized influence to states with tiny populations, such as Wyoming, at the expense of huge states like California. Over the years, many states have called for a constitutional convention on specific topics. Conservative groups argue that the requests could be aggregated to reach the 34-state threshold and force a convention. Former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, now with the American Constitution Society, just wrote a book that warns that a convention is likely if Republicans win full control of Congress next year.
They're asserting that you can mix and match these and that meets the constitutional requirements. It's not right, and the Supreme Court doesn't appear to have the authority to step in and stop it.
Jonathan Mehta Stein with Common Cause California says the risk of a runaway convention is too great because there are very few rules in place. I'm Suzanne Potter. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Ready to ride?
Just let me get my flip-flops on.
Whoa, Mom and Dad are going for a ride without their protective gear.
Quick, grab the checklist. I'll grab the gear.
Just where do you two think you're going without your safety gear?
Yeah, you know how we feel about riding without your gear.
Well, it's so nice out.
And we're only going for a short ride.
Not before you put all this gear on, you're not.
But...
riding pants?
Okay.
Check.
Motorcycle boots?
Bye-bye, flip-flops.
Check.
Armored jackets?
Nice.
Check.
Riding gloves?
Two pairs.
Check.
Last but not least, full face helmets.
Check.
Now you're ready to ride.
And you look cool.
All the gear, all the time. Zero in Wisconsin. Together, we can save lives. Learn more at Zero in.
Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, September 30th, the last calendar day of this month. Also, last calendar day of the fiscal year for the federal government. We're going to talk about that in just a few moments ago. Welcome to Morning Cannolis. This is our weekly review, our analysis, our consideration, our discussion of those most important issues, the major news stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me and my always professional, wonderfully engaged producer, Anya. Together, we are here in the studios of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha. But we are, as always, on Saturday mornings, broadcasting live through the state of Wisconsin, through the Civic Media outlets. Thank you once again for joining us on this Saturday morning. As always, we're taking your questions, your comments, your perspectives, your thoughts on the important issues we're talking about this morning and every Saturday morning. That phone number is 844-967-2789. Anya also instructs me always very wisely that you can go on the Civic Media website and find your particular broadcast station. Pull down the Morning Cannolis folder. You can also text Anya and me and get your questions, your comments, your perspectives through to us through that mechanism. Enjoying hearing from all of you this morning as every morning. We always ask here on Morning Cannolis three important questions. What happened? What are the things that are animating our country, our nation, our state? What do we know about the world out there? Why are those things important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material to the understanding of our lives? And then what are we supposed to do about those things? What are our actions? What are responses, if anything, that we can do in response to those circumstances, those events that we talk about? As always, we have an aggressive but achievable syllabus this morning. Let me tell you a little bit about that and then jump right into that syllabus, that agenda this morning for our consideration on Morning Cannolis. We're going to begin with some stories once again in the category of our returning focus of undiscovered justice. One thing having to do with climate change, and the other one you just probably heard on the news involving Tupac Shakur, of some very important litigation, criminal prosecution, civil litigation work going on out there that is important to note here on this Saturday morning. Then we're going to go to the Congress. Two very significant things happened. One, of course, the passing just yesterday of Dianne Feinstein. We're going to talk a little bit about her, her history, her legacy, and then also the looming shutdown of the federal government happening in under 14 hours from right now. We're going to talk about why that is also a rule of law issue for every single American, not just implementing the budget this morning and in the days ahead, but also affecting many, many programs, nutrition programs and airports and all sorts of things, our military payments, all sorts of things, including the operations of our federal courts and our federal Department of Justice. We're going to chat some this morning about that as well. We've got some snapshots, as always, coming out of the voting rights area, some updates on things we've talked about before. Coming out of Alabama, yes, there's once again more news. And then another state, also in the Fifth Circuit, Louisiana. We haven't talked a lot about that, but case coming out of Louisiana also implicating issues related to the Fifth Circuit. Then we're going to go back to the lawsuits involving Donald Trump, in particular, the civil case pending in New York City. prosecuted civilly in the New York court there by Letitia James, who is the attorney general of that state. Then we'd go south to the Georgia case. That, once again, a state prosecution. That one criminal. A very significant thing happened, again, just in the past 24 to 36 hours or so, having to do with a plea by one of the 19 defendants indicted in that case. And also some important news coming out of a federal court that decided in the end that all those cases need to stay in the state court. We're going to talk about all of that in our first hour here on Morning Cannolis. Looking forward to your joining me and Anya for that discussion. Also, in our second hour, talking about a variety of different important things related to the 14th Amendment, fake electors, and yes, indeed, we're also 48 hours out from the start of the new term of the Supreme Court of the United States of America. First Monday in October, we're going to begin a special segment, which we do every single fall about this time, focusing on some of the main cases. I'm going to tell you about the first three cases Supreme Court is going to be hearing this coming Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then also talk a little bit more about other things down the road that we'll be discussing, identifying some of the major cases the Supreme Court has already placed on its docket for this, the 2023-2024 term of its review and consideration of cases coming up for review. Again, in the midst of a likely shutdown of operations coming almost immediately, and also presumably affecting the federal courts in the days just ahead. Let's jump right into some of our undiscovered justice issues this morning. One of them happens to be from Europe, going overseas and involving, of course, the future of our nation, our world, young people. Young people are suing about 30 of Europe's governments over climate change issues. They brought a civil lawsuit in the European Court of Human Rights. They're filing this against those European governments, claiming with some good credibility in their international complaint here that those governments have failed to do enough to address what? To address climate change, being brought by everyone from 11-year-old and to a 24-year-old, young people bringing this lawsuit, again, in the European Court of Human Rights. How does this come about? Well, it turns out that there were some deadly wildfires, you may recall them well, in Portugal in 2017, about 6 years or so ago, killed more than 120 people. Tragedy at that time. Most people looking at that, most scientists looked at that and said, yes, just one more indication of the impact that climate change is having on our world. Now, those blazes narrowly missed the homes that were occupied by three of the young people bringing this lawsuit. Their names are Claudia, Martim, and Mariana. But it covered their garden in some ash, and it closed the school as heavy smoke choked the air at that time. And Claudia, one of the young plaintiffs in this case, said this. She said, "What I felt was fear. The wildfires made me really anxious about what sort of future I would have." And indeed, that's the predicate, that's the basis for the suit that she and her siblings have now brought against 27 EU member states, hopefully prompting them to act faster on climate change for our present and certainly for the future as well. The extreme fire season of 2017 at that time was viewed as a prelude to future conditions, and all that reported in a 2019 study that is also the basis for this lawsuit. Catastrophic event back in 2017, now resulting in this lawsuit. Paris Climate Accord, you may know well, limits and provides some restrictions on governments going forward, limiting global temperatures to well below 2 degrees Celsius and pursuing efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees. And yet, as we all know, progress on those good aspirations has been slow. Heads of state from some of the heaviest polluting countries skipping, not showing up at the UN Climate Ambition Summit this past week, and that having to do, of course, with climate control as well. A decision in the case called Duarte Agostinho and others versus Portugal and 32 other states isn't expected for months and maybe even years down the road. And so far, it's the only youth climate case making its way through those courts. But we know that earlier this year in the United States of America, a judge in Montana ruled in favor of another group of very young plaintiffs who in that jurisdiction had sued the state for violating their right to a clean environment. And that victory in that state case right here in the United States in Montana
could force that state to rewrite a policy that bars officials from considering climate change when permitting new energy projects. And we recall as well the devastating fires in Maui. In the wake of that, another youth climate suit in Hawaii expected to go to trial next year. And the Biden administration faces a federal climate suit that youth initially brought against the United States during the Obama administration. So again, this getting a lot of traction, getting a lot of focus by our young people concerned about their future. Again, these kinds of things set forth the ambitious setting forth of standards by the UN Climate Ambition Summit just last week. The predicate, again, the basis for going ahead on this lawsuit, young people, everyone from 11 years old to 24 years old, bringing that lawsuit in the European Court of Human Rights. We will monitor that in the future, part of our Undiscovered Justice this morning. Second case, back here in the United States of America, getting a fair amount of attention by the media, including right here on Civic Media. You may have heard the news. Let's go into this a little bit greater because, again, it underscores the notion of the rule of law, the importance of litigation, civil litigation, certainly that climate change litigation falls in the category of significant things going on out there. And second, the importance of continuing to keep cold cases open. This has to do with the announcement just yesterday that the murderer of Tupac Shakur has now been indicted more than 25 years after the killing of the tragic killing of that hip-hop star way back 24 years ago. The man in this case, Dwayne Keith Davis, had said in interviews and in a memoir that he was in the front passenger seat of a white Cadillac that pulled up near the vehicle that Mr. Shakur and others were in. After a 1996 prize fight between Mike Tyson and Bruce Sheldon happened in Las Vegas. So this comes out of Las Vegas, Nevada in particular. And the lawsuit, again, announced by prosecutors, the criminal prosecution, reviving this investigation after it had long been stalled. A grand jury, a specific grand jury, again, people called together to look at evidence, determining whether that there's probable cause to believe that there has been a charge, a basis for charging individuals, brought together in Clark County there in Nevada, indicted Davis on one count of murder with use of a deadly weapon plus a gang enhancement. Davis arrested in the wake of that, in custody now without bail. And despite years and years of speculation, evidence and reporting across almost three decades, 25 years or so, no charges had been ever filed in Shakur's shooting, one of the most popular artists of the 1990s. And that goes back again to the attempts by law enforcement over time to try to figure out exactly what happened. They had some leads, and in particular, most recently in July, Las Vegas police had executed a search warrant at a home in Henderson, Nevada, that was apparently connected to Davis. And as a part of this attempt to revive this case, looking not only plainly at the results of that, that brings this cold case much warmer. Also noting that in a 2019 memoir, Davis, once again the defendant in this case, he had recounted this gang dispute that escalated between Shakur and his associates involving the beating of Davis's nephew, a fellow named Orlando Anderson, following this boxing match in the MGM Grand. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about how this cold case became very hot leading to this indictment. Undiscovered and pursue justice right now in America. Stay with us for that discussion and more right here on Morning Cannolis.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season. From clipping your horse for competition season, to keeping the backyard birds well-fed season. And of course, loving your pets like family season. There's a reason people say, if Fleet Farm doesn't have it, you don't need it. Because we have it all. Fleet Farm. Built for real life.
Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
He shouldn't even have BLTs. They're a terrible sandwich.
Oh, I love BLTs.
That's so like
the
do
one,
I.
The one deli sandwich I could have.
Greg, don't yuck my yum, dude.
I will.
We've already established on this show today that Greg is happy to judge people's yums.
Bring me your yums, for I am the yum judge.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Do support the legalization, regulation, and taxation of legal cannabis in the state of Wisconsin. You said yes, Melissa. That was like 12 years ago. What do you think the hangup is?
It's the Republicans. They're suffering from reefer madness. They're out of touch legislators in the Capitol building who don't want to give a win to Governor Evers and Democrats.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Under the helmet with the gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Jordan Love was 15 for 27 for 245 yards and 3 TDs against a JV team.
Oh, my God. I mean, I don't like Chicago, but I ain't going to call them a JV team. They suck, but it's a slap in the face. Okay. I'm laughing at y'all Bear fans.
I know, man.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger with Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday mornings at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back. It is Saturday, September 30th. This is Morning Cannolis, and we're talking about these two matters in the category of undiscovered justice, but actually now rediscovered in respect to the proposed pursuit and the return of an indictment of the murderer of Tupac Shakur more than 25 years ago, right before the break, talking about the circumstances that prompted this cold case suddenly to become a part of the prosecution focus of the Clark County District Attorney out there. According to the copy of the indictment that was filed in the Clark County District Court, the defendant in this case, Davis, is charged with obtaining a gun for the purpose of seeking retribution against Mr. Shakur and Mr. Knight. And again, another person in the car that night, and of handing off the weapon either to his nephew, that is Davis's nephew, or someone else in this Cadillac that was driving by with the intent that this crime be committed. Davis, this to this day, the only person in the car who is still alive. Now, the DA acknowledged in court that the broad outlines of what are set forth in this indictment had occurred that night. Those things were well known to the police as far back as 1996. He went on to say this. He said what was lacking was admissible evidence to establish this particular chain of events. He, that is Davis, in his book, his memoir called Compton Street Legend, he admitted within that book that he did acquire the firearm with the intent to go hunt down Tupac Shakur and Mr. Knight. And again, at this news conference on Friday, Las Vegas police confirmed that Davis's own words had reinvigorated the case. Again, his own words in his memoir published many years ago, starting with a television appearance he made in 2018. And the prosecutors, the investigators said at the time, "We knew at this time that this was likely our last chance to take a run at this case, and indeed they have done so." Now, we should very quickly add that, of course, any defendant in America, including state prosecutions, federal prosecutions, presumed innocent until proven guilty, but fairly compelling evidence now, not only based upon Davis's own words, things he has said publicly, things in his memoir, and presumably now the results of this recent search warrant that was also executed at the home in Henderson, Nevada, somehow connected to Davis as well. We don't know all the details behind that. But again, rule of law promoted this past week when, even after all of these years, the tragic, horrific death, the murder of Tupac Shakur, is in some ways vindicated, never returned to us. Still a tragedy, our nation's history, certainly a tragedy for all of us. And now as a result of tenacious work by law enforcement there in Nevada, the presumed and charged murderer, Dwayne Davis, brought to justice, now in custody for that 25-year-old murder of Tupac Shakur. A couple of things focusing on undiscovered justice this morning. Let's move on to a couple of other things happening in our United States Congress. And in particular, let's begin, as we should, appropriate this morning, recognizing the recent death, just yesterday of Dianne Feinstein, who was this lion, this iconic person in our United States Congress. She was born on June 22nd of 1933. She's a San Francisco native, as I suspect all of you know. She graduated from Stanford University in 1955. A lot of her history predated her time in the United States Senate. All of this part of our history woven in and out of who we are as a fabric of America. Elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1969 and served as the board's first female president in 1978, just under 10 years after that. And it was during that time, that our nation, certainly the state of California, the city of San Francisco, suffered these horrific assassinations of Mayor George Moscone and City Supervisor Harvey Milk. A lot of focus, a lot of appropriate focus on the history of that time, drawing national attention to those horrific things happening in that city at that time. Feinstein was the person, the official in the city of San Francisco government who succeeded Moscone as mayor and became the first woman to serve in that position after that tragic event, responsible then not only for moving the city not beyond those murders, but attempting as best she can to ensure that there's a full investigation of them. Indeed, there was. Prosecutions followed, as you well know. But again, understanding that event as a landmark issue in our history, and also then becoming, as I said, the first woman to serve in the position of mayor, responsible for fiscal integrity, for administrative work, for the governing of the city of San Francisco. It was during her tenure that she led the renovation of that city's cable car system. And indeed, 1984, the Democratic National Convention in the city of San Francisco, while Dianne Feinstein is the mayor there. She survived a recall attempt in 1983 and was a very popular mayor after that and was named the most effective mayor in the country by a group called City and State in 1987. She went on to lose a race for governor in 1990, but that may have been to our collective benefit in some way. She was elected to the U.S. Senate a couple of years later in 1992 in a special election. And in November of 1992 in particular, becoming that state's first female U.S. senator. And shortly after, she became the state's senior senator after Alan Cranston retired in January of 1993. And again, a member of the Senate since that time. Re-elected to the United States Senate from California five different times. In the January 2012 election, she received 7.86 million votes, the most popular votes received by any U.S. Senate candidate in history. She authored, during her stellar time in the United States Senate, the all-important 1994 federal assault weapons ban, a law that plainly lapsed after 10 years, something that she was very much focused on, firearms in America, recognizing 1990s and certainly in the many years that followed, the great challenges posed by firearms and the use of those weapons to compromise our safety and security, a great advocate for firearms control and restrictions in this country, the first woman to have chaired the Senate Rules and the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the first woman to have presided over a U.S. presidential inauguration. Important to note that in that category, in that capacity, in the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, some very significant things that she did. She did that showed great courage. When we come back, I'll tell you more about those right here on Morning Cannolis. And since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one. So will the real men get up? I know you're fed up, ladies, but keep your head up. If you want to do Tupac throughout the show.
Broadcasting from the City Deck Studios on North Washington Street, the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. There's no government shutdown after House Speaker Kevin McCarthy recruited Democrats to help pass a short-term funding measure President Biden ultimately signed just before midnight. But today, McCarthy's chief Republican critic, Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida, tells ABC's This Week he will introduce a motion to remove McCarthy as the Speaker of the House.
If at this time, next week, Kevin McCarthy is still Speaker of the House, it will be because the Democrats bailed him out, and he can be their Speaker, not mine.
Gates was on ABC's This Week. Meanwhile, congressional supporters of military aid for Ukraine says there will be more. That's after the short-term measure that passed Saturday did not include any aid. About 28 million student loan borrowers back on the hook today after the federal pause on payments comes to an end after 3 years. And Turkey's interior minister says a suicide bomb in the capital of Ankara occurred before parliament was set to reopen and two police officers were slightly hurt. This is ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
The Green Bay Packers call Lambeau Field home, but did you know the stadium has a history all its own? It started with where to build it. Residents on both sides of the city wanted it. Officials argued there had to be room for growth. Eventually, farmland was purchased, but in Ashwaubenon. The bargaining continued, and in 1956, the land was annexed to Green Bay. Green Bay City Stadium became a reality the following year and was renamed in honor of team co-founder and coach Curly Lambeau in 1965. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
Mino and the mayor.
I want to talk about the two of you. And what I love the most about it is the excitement for Green Bay. You guys, both of you have a passion for our area. When you talk about the local events, you're not just talking about, hey, it's at this location at this time. Like, you know, oh, there's this race that they do or they do this cake thing. Like, you know it so well. And I love the energy that you bring to this show.
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
And on the Civic Media app.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Aaron comes in every day looking like he just stepped out of a Turkish bathhouse because it's so hot in there. Just to recap, so far this segment has been filled with dog vomit, old men peeing, and Aaron wearing a dish towel. So we're...
Hey man, your name's on the show. Your name's on the show.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8.
On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999. And again, 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats. And there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger. Featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW and on the Civic Media app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining me and Anya here on the broadcast studios and stations of Civic Media. This is Morning Cannolis. Again, always taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Also taking your texts on the app at Civic Media, your broadcast station, and Morning Cannolis. Be in touch with us. Communicate with us about the issues of this day. Right before the break, talking about this lion, this iconic member of the United States Congress in our nation's history, not just in the Congress, but also state of California, nationwide, the death this past week of Dianne Feinstein. We mourn that today. We recognize as well that during the course of her tenure in the United States Senate, she's chaired the Senate Intelligence Committee from 2009 to 2015, also served as the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee from 2017 to 2021. During her time as chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, also a lion, also a wonderful representative of courage in the United States Senate. At that time, reporting coming out, she had done a lot of investigative work through her official auspices there in the United States Congress about abuses by the CIA in the wake of 9/11 and other matters. She brought those to the attention of the nation. She did that over the objection of the White House at the time. And I recall this well. I was U.S. attorney at the time, obviously not involved in this particular issue, but a big, big issue at the time about the disclosure of these abuses by the CIA in terms of its attempts. Its attempts, again, domestically, but mostly overseas, to address issues related to intelligence, doing some things both domestically and overseas that plainly ran afoul not only of our laws, but also our fundamental notions about what our government should be doing. Dianne Feinstein brought those to the attention of the American population on the floor of the United States Senate. Again, a major figure in doing just that. She was criticized heavily for it, but felt strongly, as she did in all the other areas that she focused on during her career, that this was something that the American people needed to know about. And certainly in the wake of that, in the wake of her courageous decision to do just that, to disclose these CIA abuses, received an awful lot of approval because of the light that was shown upon this misconduct, this misbehavior by one of our major federal agencies. We mourn today Dianne Feinstein's death, her passing, even as we look forward to the naming by the governor of the state of California of someone who will take her position in the United States Senate. Her seat now up for election in about a year from now. There are three members of the House of Representatives who have already announced their candidacy long before she died. Gavin Newsom indicating that he will make an appointment, almost certainly, probably not of one of those three who is presently running for that position, but for somebody who will take the position and hold it for the year before the election coming up in November. Today, once again, we remember with great fondness Dianne Feinstein and all that she has been to this nation, to the Congress, the people of the state of California, and again, derivatively and directly to the people of the state of Wisconsin, other places throughout our great nation. We also look to Washington, D.C. these days because, as I indicated before, less than 14 hours from now, highly likely that once again, as we have seen in the past, our United States government is going to go without a budget. Not the first time this has happened, not the first time that our Congress, our House, our Senate, and yes, indeed, the president as well, responsible for signing off on a budget ultimately, but presented to him by the United States Congress, has failed to do their job in keeping the government up and running. What's happening? Well, it appears now that there is no agreement coming out of the United States Congress, the House of Representatives in particular, and stymied by the group of Republican members of the House of Representatives who are basically stopping movements going forward to do one of two things. There should be a budget put in place by United States Congress. That's what's contemplated by the Constitution. But short of that, even late this past week, an attempt to do a kind of a stop-hold a mechanism here to ensure that the government does not go broke, if you will, in the next 14 hours or so, even that effort to continue the government operation for about a month, that effort as well fails in the House of Representatives. The Senate, as you know well, has already put together a plan, a project that does have bipartisan support to keep the government in place. Again, all of that premised upon an agreement put together many, many months ago in connection with the debt ceiling. All of this now being revisited because of a small number of members of the House of Representatives who want to shut things down. And they are here plainly to stop government from operation, not premised upon a particular issue, but upon this notion that once again, because you can do it, they will do it. And so the government now, almost certainly, in about 14 hours from now, less than 14 hours, is going to shut down. Not in every aspect, because once again, a couple of things happen. There are mechanisms in our fiscal laws and in our operational principles that will keep some very fundamental operations in place. But many of those, if not all of those operations, go with unpaid government workers. And that includes not only people responsible for major programs, nutrition programs, family support programs, humanity supporting programs, delays at airports almost certainly because of this sort of thing, our military not paid for the important work that they will continue to do unpaid while this budget issue remains unresolved. I mentioned last broadcast and also once again this morning, this also has an implication for the rule of law. Now, what's going to happen? I mentioned already that the United States Supreme Court has its first official day of its operation, the first Monday in October, the first time of its new term coming up beginning at 9 a.m. this coming Monday, October 2nd. And it turns out that federal courts will be able to operate normally for about 2 weeks without some interruption, mainly because they've got some funds, they've got some other mechanisms for keeping things afloat. But court budgets will do that for only so long. And obviously that also has an impact upon other related federal entities, including the U.S. Department of Justice. I recall when I was U.S. attorney, we also had a shutdown during that time. And I had the great displeasure of having to tell people on my staff and others in the staffs of related agencies, investigative agencies inside the federal government, that they had to go home and could not work, and there was no promise at the time for pay. Now, that does two things. One, first of all, of course, it has an implication for the basic attitude, the spirit of good working, hardworking government officials, people who are there to provide federal government service. Sending them home and telling them they cannot do their jobs has a dramatic impact upon the way in which government works. Along the way, of course, no promise of pay. Congress has always come back and restored that pay after the shutdowns happen. And that indeed happened during the time of the Obama administration as well. But I can tell you that it does indeed impact the capacity of U.S. attorney's offices. And although I do not know with great specificity, I can assure you, based upon the past history, that there are plans right now to send staff people of the U.S. Department of Justice and other federal agencies home, telling them to stay home on Monday morning because there's no funding. What happens, of course, is that during the course of the next days, weeks, however long this lasts, what all these agencies will do is what we did way back when, and that is to sort of move people in and out to ensure that there's some coverage for the things that need to be done. And so there are mechanisms, but that too takes time and resources that should be spent doing other things supporting the operation of government, including the U.S. Department of Justice, including federal investigative agencies, federal administrative agencies across the board. You name them. All of the federal agencies are going to be affected by this. Anticipate slowdowns in responses to who? To the constituents who necessarily rely on the good work of those federal agencies day after day. That's going to be affected almost immediately, but certainly you will begin to feel it in the days just ahead. Again, we note this is true of the federal courts, not immediately, but as the days go on, also implicated in this shutdown event happening. The editorial here, of course, is implicit in what I've already said, which is the government has an obligation to all of us to continue these functions, its programs, its initiatives that are required by law, required by the Constitution. We should expect, if nothing less, that the government will pass and put in place a budget. Can you imagine any other agency, any other private entity, a corporation, a for-profit entity, a not-for-profit agency that comes forward and says to the board of directors, as the CEO, as the CFO, the chief executive officer, we don't have a budget, and for that reason, we need to shut down. What would happen under normal circumstances? Well, certainly the board of directors of that entity, whatever it is, would almost certainly be obliged to resign. The CEO, CFO, for not doing their jobs, not keeping the place operationally up and running, also certainly required to resign, if not fired, for failing to do that fundamental work, which is keeping the operation in place, keeping it up and running. Our United States Congress is failing us. And yes, I know well that this is as a result of politics and partisan government going on right now. And those folks should be shamed by virtue of what is happening right now, because it does not only implicate all of these programs, all these initiatives, the things that government does on a regular basis, but also makes the most important, most significant, strongest nation on the face of the planet look as if, and it's true, that we cannot keep our own fiscal house in order. Call your representatives. Tell them to keep us up in the budget arena where we've got a budget in place. Let's stop this cycle of budget suspension where we do this every several months, certainly every year, it seems. Let's put us back in the constitutional compliance to ensure that we've got a budget going forward. Both of those things happening, again, out of our United States Congress just this past week. Things related to the budget continuing for days yet to come. Let's go across the parking lot there on Capitol Hill and talk about the United States Supreme Court. We're going to spend some time in our second hour this day also talking about the start of the new calendar year, the new term of the Supreme Court, again, starting on Monday morning, October 2nd, 2023. some significant events, again, in this case coming out of Alabama. We have talked a lot about it. This is the matter that has been up to the United States Supreme Court already. The United States Supreme Court in this major case called Allen versus Milligan, also sometimes called Merrill versus Milligan, telling the Alabama legislature that it had failed to comply with the Voting Rights Act in drawing its lines as it did. Alabama has seven congressional districts. The legislature there drawing only one of them to ensure that members of the black population there have the right and the opportunity to select and to send to Congress people of their choice. The lower courts, the district court, the federal court, the Fifth Circuit, telling the legislature repeatedly that they need to ensure that there are two majority black districts there in Alabama. And the Alabama legislature very recently, just weeks ago, was saying, nope, we're not doing that, drawing a map that is plainly in non-compliance with what the United States Supreme Court and these other courts have said. Seeking again review this latest this past week before the United States Supreme Court, once again, to stop the lower court, in this case the Fifth Circuit, from going ahead drawing its own map using a cartographer, using a special master to draw this map in a way that the legislature itself will not do. The legislature going to the Supreme Court once again and saying, please tell that lower court, tell the Fifth Circuit to stop doing what it's doing. The Supreme Court appropriately on Tuesday of this week in a one-sentence order, which is significant in and of itself, telling Alabama, telling the legislature to stop it, that they've got to comply with the Voting Rights Act. They've got to comply with what the Supreme Court has said previously. And yes, they have to comply with what this three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit is now doing, which is putting together maps in a way that the legislature itself has failed to do. It's vindicated they have hired a special master and a cartographer. Those folks have returned as late as this past Monday, again, these congressional maps that add this second district with majority black voters. It is there. It is in place. The cartographer, the special master, giving the three-judge panel these recommendations about what they should do to be in compliance with what the law requires and what the courts have said the legislature has got to do. That happening just this past week. The Supreme Court, once again, in a one-sentence order, saying, nope, we're not going to consider this anymore. We are done, Alabama legislature, with this, and you now need to comply with this. As one of our great callers questioned last week, what happens? What happens in the situation where the state of Alabama, even after the Fifth Circuit, and they almost certainly will, establishes these new lines with the two majority black districts in the state of Alabama? What happens for implementation purposes in Alabama? We know well from our Constitution that the Constitution requires that state officials set the rules and circumstances of elections. So this goes back to the state to implement. When we come back, we'll once again ponder that issue. And then we're going to talk about Louisiana, which also has its own rule of law issue now in the news of America. Stay with us for that discussion.
That's the way it is. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh, yeah.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out!
All right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic Sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Red Delicious, Honeycrisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
And we are back. We are talking in this last segment of our first hour here in Morning Cannolis about the latest coming out of the Alabama circumstances. The Supreme Court just this past Tuesday telling the Alabama legislature yet again, as it has been told multiple times in recent weeks and months, that it needs, in fact, to comply with the Voting Rights Act. And we now have the three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit, through its cartographer, through its special master, drawing the very maps that the legislature has failed to do, the new maps coming out of that effort of the three-judge panel, basically leave District 7, which is sort of in western Alabama, as the one of the two majority black districts out of seven in the state, where more than one-fourth of the residents there are black. The new maps being proposed to the Fifth Circuit also identify District 2, which is sort of in the middle portion, the middle southern portion of the state, as the second majority black district. Those maps now being presented to the three-judge panel for imposition, and presumably sometime very soon, the three-judge panel is going to tell the state of Alabama it needs to do this, needs to implement these new maps that have been put together by the courts and imposed upon the state of Alabama because its own legislature fails to follow not only the rule of law, but also the clear directives of federal courts on a regular basis. It will be concerning if there is any attempt by members of the official offices of the state of Alabama to push back even further. As we know under the Constitution, other cases that we have talked about, the Constitution place in authority of the states a responsibility for the conduct of elections, including things like preparing maps, ballots, all those kinds of things that make elections go. We will anticipate, will we not, that the representatives in Alabama, now being told repeatedly that they need to do this, will in fact comply with all of that, and that the litigation portion of this, the compulsion portion of this to require compliance with the Voting Rights Act, is now over. And Alabama, including all of its residents, will look forward to the 2024 election with two majority black districts out of its seven. We will keep on top of that story plainly as enforcement actions and activities go forward. We also know that coming out of another state in the Fifth Circuit, Louisiana, a significant thing in the opposite direction also happening just this past week. A federal appeals court, again, has stopped the redrawing of Louisiana's map of congressional voting districts. And again, this further complicates a long-running legal fight over voting strength in the South among black voters. The case plainly among all of these attempts in the southern states and in other states in our country to address attempts in any event to change the ways in which the Voting Rights Act is applied. And plainly, its resolution could affect the balance of power in the House of Representatives. Once again, as we talked before, right now failing to do its job in keeping the government in place. Fifth Circuit, a three-judge panel just this past week voted 2-1 to cancel a district court hearing for selecting a new redistricting plan that a U.S. District Court judge named Shelley Dick had scheduled to start on October 3rd. That's this Tuesday, this coming week. The district court judge previously had found that the lines have been drawn by the legislature there in Louisiana. Again, this sounds very familiar, does it not? Had failed to comply with the Voting Rights Act and had scheduled this hearing beginning on October 3rd to address that that specific situation. The Court of Appeals just this past week had said this. The district court, again, Judge Dick, the Court of Appeals said, did not follow the law of the Supreme Court of this court. Its action in rushing redistricting via a court-ordered map is a clear abuse of his discretion for which there is no alternative means of appeal. That was written by U.S. Circuit Court Judge Edith Jones. She wrote the majority opinion. It was joined in by another judge named James Ho. Circuit Judge Stephen Higginson, he dissented. He pointed out in a separate opinion, he was a dissenting voice in this 2-1 vote, that the GOP state officials had already appealed Judge Dick's preliminary injunction ruling. And next week, a separate panel of the Fifth Circuit is going to be hearing all of that. So all of this now before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which could, in fact, review that matter. This case could once again be going to the United States Supreme Court. The court, again, had previously found that the new congressional map that had been put together by the legislature violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. We've talked a lot about that, this basic prohibition in our Voting Rights Act since the 1960s that prohibits discrimination based upon race. The judge, District Court Judge Shelley Dick, finding that map that the legislature had put together diluted the voting power of black Louisianans. Just like the situation in sister state Alabama in the Fifth Circuit as well. Now, as a result of this decision by this three-judge panel to tell Judge Dick not to go ahead to select this new redistricting plan, all that's suspended now. And again, this is the latest twist, of course, in this redistricting lawsuit, almost certainly going to end up again before the United States Supreme Court. In the past, the state GOP officials there had appealed the case to the Supreme Court. And among other questions, they had asked the Supreme Court to determine whether in Louisiana, which groups of voting age populations should be categorized as black. That was their question to the Supreme Court in a previous petition to the United States Supreme Court, asking the high judge panel to weigh in on whether Louisianans of voting age should be categorized as black when they were testing this redistricting plan. Interestingly, they have now filed some new pleadings in all this litigation, in which they prepare and present a novel argument. And it's premised upon another case coming out of the Supreme Court that we have talked about just this past summer. And that is the case involving Harvard and the University of North Carolina finding, as we know well from the Supreme Court, that the officials who are reviewing applications for admissions in our major universities, all our universities in the United States, private institutions, public institutions, cannot use race, at least not overtly, in making decisions about incoming classes. That was a case involving Harvard and UNC, a major case changing decades of policy and practice established and saying that race cannot be the basis for determining who is going to get into our nation's universities. Interestingly, in this Louisiana case, the attorneys who are attempting to support the Louisiana line drawing done by the legislature that, again, does not, in fact, acknowledge the true population of black voters in Louisiana, they're preparing this novel argument to defend the legislature-approved map. They cite that Supreme Court's recent ruling on affirmative action to argue this, to argue that the race-based redistricting under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act may no longer be constitutional as a result of that other Supreme Court opinion. We will continue to take a look at this case, also in Louisiana, as it progresses. Stay with us for the second hour here on Morning Cannolis. Lots more to get to, including litigation coming out of New York and Georgia involving our former president. Be with us for that important discussion coming up right after this top of the hour break.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and
and over and over and over and over, then surely you'll check NHTSA.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, can potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian.